One thing that Rich has always emphasized, he emphasized it to me when I was just starting out, is the importance of forming a practice that was very regular or daily. Daily is the best. Like whether it be Zen meditation, whether it be Hindu puja, whether it be any number of modern religious traditions, daily practice is something that is important. That commitment to come at and be present and be acting in the context of your spiritual practice, no matter what it is, every day, whether you're sick or not. It doesn't always have to be elaborate. It can be, you can have really short forms, you can have long forms, you can do it with physical stuff, physical offerings, except if it's really bad or you're traveling or something, by all means, do it just in words. This does something to us. It changes the way we perceive, and it changes our brains ultimately. I mean, I think that there's research on this on really, really well-trained and seasoned monks from like Tibet and places like that. Their brains, their attention, their brainwaves are different. Now, that doesn't happen because you sit down and say you're going to meditate and you've done it three times. And it was, one was last week and one was today, and then you did it again tonight. That doesn't change your brain. It's the constant returning to, the constant placing energy into those nodes that does it. And Rich expressed it in terms of forming a relationship with a god or a goddess. And he would, and what we would say is, who is the god or goddess that most attracts you? Start there. And we have a form called the brief daily ritual or brief morning ritual, where it's a very, very condensed form of our group rituals. And then you can do those. You can, if one part seems like it's hard to do for some reason, you can, like I say, just maybe do the words or abridge the words. More important is doing it than doing any specific thing. It's not like if you don't say everything exactly like this, the magic won't work. Egyptian was never like that. I mean, well, no, I have to say that. In sometimes it was like that. And the words do matter. Don't get me wrong here. But it's in this case, in this our own personal context, getting to know the gods and goddesses and becoming known by the gods and goddesses, if that is something that we can be flexible with. And you just have to be persistent. And it changes your perceptions. It can you're not going to get necessarily a big zing every single time you do this. That's not the point. I think that anybody who is mature in almost any tradition will tell you that just doesn't happen all the time. But it does happen sometimes. And if you're not prepared, you actually don't perceive it, I think. Unless it's one of those knock you upside the head things, being knocked flat on your butt, on the road to Damascus, like Paul got, right? I mean, there are those too. That happens too. I've actually experienced both, but some of them are quite subtle. They're just they're like a like just a flavor that happens. And flavor, I'm trying to be as synesthetic as I can there. That changes. The something's changed, something's different. And it's doing the practices over and over again that I think make you tune into
One of
that
the
happening.
and I totally agree with you, and I get what you're saying. And one of the ways that I kind of explain it, or I think about it, is, you know, if you do a spell once, a magic spell for money, say, and you get the money that you need, that's cool. But with a daily practice, especially like the one you're talking about, where you're interfacing with your chosen deity on a daily basis, it just makes your overall life better. And, you know, I might be projecting or something, but it just seems like it just makes your life better. Like, right, all in general and all aspects.
Perfect. I'm so glad you said that. The reason I'm glad you said that is something I have not brought up about the Kemetic polytheism and reconstruction that we do. What is the reason we do this?
Mm-hmm.
And there is a reason. What is the reason? The reason, and it is a life-changing thing. We are bound in our hearts, minds, centers to do ma'at and speak ma'at. Ma'at is what matters. What we are doing in our concept structures are helping to increase ma'at. That's justice, truth, right, balance,
mm-hmm.
in the world, in the universe. Rituals are how you do that. I mean, it's everyday behavior as well. You know, it's not biting the head off of the stressed pizza delivery boy who it ain't his fault that it's cold, right? Mm-hmm. It's not that. That's the kind of behavior that you certainly don't want to do. That's not fair. It's not just. It's not balanced, right? Yeah. It's not even true. It's selfish. It's childish. You know, it's any number of things. But the rituals themselves are literally meant to help maintain the world.
Yeah,
this is true of ancient Egyptian temples. Temples were not places for congregations to get together and sing hymns.
Right.
There were hymns sung in temples by special choirs, for sure. But that is a part of the ritual sets. It was like, as some Egyptological writers have said, it's like a giant power station, dynamo, engine, an engine to effect ma'at by working in partnership with the gods and goddesses,
yeah,
to uphold ma'at. So we are part of the responsibility. We have responsibility. This is why we do it. Because ma'at isn't something that happens by itself. Ma'at is something that can fall apart at any time.
Sure.
And I think we have abundant evidence to that right now. In this world, in this country, in lots of places. And the thing is, it's illusory to think that it's not that way pretty much all the time.
Right.
Egyptians saw the world as being a wonderful place. It's not, the world itself is not something to run away from or despise or think that you're a spirit and therefore above it all. Mm-hmm. The world is for enjoyment. It is for life. It is, but it is also constantly in danger of going off the rails.
Sure.
And so the ritual structures and proper behaviors, Egyptian has an entire literature of this stuff. As well, and autobiographical literature that explains it. It's not just ritual texts. It's built throughout the culture.
Mm-hmm.
Is that we have responsibility to help maintain it. And yeah. the gods do too. The gods and goddesses aren't just, you know, we don't just supplicate them and then they do all the work. No, it's both of us doing the work.
Right.
It's all of us doing the work. There is in some, that's another way where people and gods blend in a way that's a little different than a lot of Western religious approaches.
Mm-hmm.
The God of Christianity is highly transcendent. The gods of Egypt are highly present, immanent.
Right.
You know, Maat, Shu is not just the god of air. Shu is wind, air, space, atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
Maat is truth. Maat isn't goddess of truth. Maat is truth. Maat is justice. It's you have to kind of turn a little trick in your head to get this in really deeply internalized, that the world is a place of relationship fundamentally. For an example of someone who writes like this, who is totally not in our tradition, a really wonderful writer is Robin Wall Kimmerer.
Okay.
She is a Native American person who actually is rediscovering her Native American legacies and, you know, and including the language, because she wasn't raised speaking her language.
Mm-hmm.
She's a registered member of the Potawatomi tribe, which is a group that's in the upper Midwest around the Great Lakes region.
Uh-huh.
Generally, but they're spread all over the place. And she is also a scientist, a working ecological bryologist, which means she studies, it's like a subspecialty of botany. She studies mosses. She studies mosses.
Wow.
And she has written a couple of really, really fabulous books. I recommend them to any pagan person, actually, about, because they talk so very, very much about responsibility to the earth,
mm-hmm.
responsibility to each other,
yeah,
and to our various kinds of spiritual traditions. That might be the lesser note here. She's especially concerned with the earth and things that we can be responsible for. You know, how can we leave our environment better off than it was when we came into it?
Yeah.
What can we actually give back that makes the world better? And that right there is what we as Kemetics do with, and we call that Maat.
And it's interesting what you've just been talking about and relating it to Maat, because one sentence from the CES, Church of Eternal Source website back in the day really changed my viewpoint, that said that every Egyptian ritual ultimately serves Maat.
Correct.
So, you know, doesn't matter which deity you do your rituals for, ultimately it serves Maat.
Correct. And it serves Maat, and in a very important way, it is an embodiment of Maat.
Mm-hmm.
And when we do this, we also make the gods more present in this world.
Yes.
And in ourselves.
Right.
And because religion isn't just about becoming powerful. It should ultimately be about, and here's something also from a different tradition, the Dalai Lama says it should be all about becoming a better person.
Absolutely.
You know, if it's not doing that, there's something's a little off.
Right.
It doesn't matter whether you do every little Gazinta Gazalta of, you know, Tibetan Buddhist practice.
Mm-hmm.
It finds something that actually helps you do that.
Yeah.
Become a better person, become calmer, right. Become more in control, become more more just perceptive of other people's needs and sufferings, you will have accomplished a lot. And that will actually start giving back right there. And Robin Wall Kimmerer, you know, expresses that in different ways. Egyptians express it in yet another set of ways. And I think that that is a kind of an important lesson for people who come from maybe the more Western esoteric traditions, where it's all about, oh, I'm getting magical power over. Really, power over is not what this is mostly about. It is magic is something that was given to humans by the sun god Ra in order for people to deal with life, daily life, stuff, things that happen. It's built in. Heka or magic is actually another very, very fundamental concept. We don't have time to go into it. But it's built into the universe. It's like a fundamental, it's like a gluon. It's like a fundamental force. Ma'at and Heka are kind of fundamental forces in a way too. Almost like these really, really, really abstract physics forces or subatomic power, subatomic forces and particles. But those are metaphors. Those are obviously metaphors. It's not like they literally are in the same sense that science would say so. But they have that kind of fundamental character that so much is built upon them. So now let me pull back from all of that. You asked me a question earlier before we started recording about pronunciations and my own, also my own passions, my own work. I want to sort of bring that up. So as I do that, I'm going to make a segue into the second book, Everlasting Egypt.
Awesome.
When Rich died, because that's related, this is going to segue. When just before Rich passed away, or actually in the next couple of years before, he was working on this book, Everlasting Egypt.
Thank you.
It was meant to be a way to publish a lot of rituals for gods, individual gods and goddesses. So these are general rituals. These are the rituals we perform together as a group. They're very hard for a single person to perform, by the way, mainly because you're going to be flubbing with a text all the time. And that kind of takes you out of it. You know, like looking up and down, if you go to an opera and you have a libretto in front of you on your lap and you go up and down and up and down and up and down, you don't see all the opera. You don't hear the music.
Right.
So it's better when there's more than one for these larger rituals. But they can be done. I have done them and others of us have done them. It's just that it's hard and it might not be your first. You're more likely to get frustrated than anything else as a beginner. So I would just say
I've done them as well. I did the brief ritual mostly because it's easily memorizable. It flows. It takes between 10 and 15 minutes depending on if you even add some stuff. Like I even added, you know, some gestures and stuff like that to my brief ritual practice. But I did, when I had a day off or on the weekends, I would often do the general ritual, and it's meant to be read. And there is a few, but just a few parts where you're doing a ritual, like presenting the food or pouring the libation, presenting ma'at, that part is better off if you could memorize it or are at least familiar with it.
Yes.
Beforehand, you know, I definitely kind of went easy on myself, understanding that one hand is going to be holding the book and the other hand presenting the food and trying to stay in the moment. But regardless, I still found it very, very enjoyable.
Good.
And the one thing that strikes me, even with the English translation of the Egyptian text, is the rhythm of these rituals is enchanting.
Yes, it is. And I will, and that actually is part of my passion right there, what you just said. I want to say that congratulations. That's great that you can do it. And if, you know, it helps sometimes, like if you have it in electronic copy, both of these books are available.
Yeah.
In Kindle or Barnes and Noble e-reader formats. Depending on which one you have. Nook. If you have Nook, you can use a Nook. If you have Kindle, you can use a Kindle. Yeah. And sometimes the electronic copy might be a bit easier because you just kind of scroll. That's helpful. Memorization is certainly helpful. I'm entirely working from memory when I do my own version of Brief Daily Ritual, which basically most days I do a pretty a rather elaborated version of that. So I do incense. I do more in Egyptian than we do normally. I open the doors. I open the shrine outer doors, then the inner doors. I've got more steps. I definitely have more steps. And if sometimes I will actually do the lights, you know, have candles and. I do that too. And there's various ways of doing that more or less elaborately. And I do it for three gods. I do it for three gods and goddesses. And one of the gods there actually has two forms. So part of it actually is sort of, there's an, you know, it's 1, 2, 3, A, 3, B. So there's a lot of repetition in what I do, which is longer than what a person should maybe start with. But you can elaborate and you can actually work this for more than one god or goddess. So we wanted to, Heat Rich wanted to have a lot more of our more up-to-date rituals available.
Yeah.
And he also wanted to include some that had not been an Eternal Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
So Everlasting Egypt is not a complete overworking of a reworking of Eternal Egypt. Some things in Eternal Egypt, like the Sa'ahu rites I mentioned earlier, like the bodily apotheosis, which basically means it's a kind of sacred way of washing and associating each part of your body with a god or goddess.
Yes.
And that is something that's in Eternal Egypt, but not in Everlasting. Mm-hmm. So, but Everlasting, instead of there being three general rituals, which is what was in Eternal, one for Set or Swutish, one for Sekhmet,
mm-hmm.
Sekhmet, and I think the third one was for Juhuti.
Yes.
Those three are there, but altogether there are 29. So 29 gods and goddesses.
Yeah, that's so cool.
And then there are four annual rituals and four lunar rituals.
Yep.
And the four, and you'd explain this, there's the four are actually more complicated than that because the New Year's ritual, Wep Rempet, actually has three supplemental rituals that go with it and one anointing ritual that goes with it.
Yeah.
Which those can be done, I usually will do one supplemental and then the anointing, or maybe we'll just do the anointing. So they're kind of a, you can adjust what you end up doing in terms of elaborations.
Yeah.
And the Wep Rempet ritual actually has right built into it a Sekhmet ritual, a full Sekhmet ritual.
Right.
So you don't have to be flipping in the book. You don't have to flip the book. Then there's the Brilliant Festival of the Lights of Neat,
mm-hmm.
which is a really nice one. And that has a full Neat ritual built in, as well as the festival parts. Then there's the Reconciliation of the Brother Gods.
Yep.
Now that relates to Horus and Seth,
right.
who are famously, you know, battling each other in certain circumstances. But in others, they have to be cooperative. And so the reconciliation effects that's their that's the point where they come together and actually are cooperating, because the two of them together are the ones who unite the lands. And then there's the Mysteries of Osir, and the Mysteries of Osir has three parts to it. There's a preliminary, and then a first and a second part, and they're each ritually different. And those are generally done one after the other. Then we have the lunar ones are the crescent ritual, which is for the first visible crescent. That's the very first day of the lunar month.
Right.
So what, formally, that should be the new moon, not the dark of the moon, the new moon. And then there's the quarter moon, which is the sixth day festival. That's what it's called in Egypt.
Yep.
And that has three different pieces. No, I'm sorry, two different pieces. One for the beloved dead, and one for the reassembling the six parts of the lunar eye.
Mm-hmm.
The Egyptians saw the Wajet eye as actually being six different pieces, which, by the way, represent numerical fractions.
Which is so cool.
Yes.
So cool.
And they don't add up to one. They add up to 63 64s.
Now, why is that?
Oh, because there's a special sauce. So that's the sixth day feast or the quarter moon, and then there's a full moon ritual.
Mm-hmm.
These are very, they're partially based on text, they're partially abridgments and adaptations, because the records on these, we know they existed, but the records on them are very spotty,
mm-hmm.
depending on which one we're talking about.
Yeah.
And I need to dive into all the details of that but I haven't gotten there yet. So I wanted to just say that's what Everlasting Egypt is. That's the one we use today. And here's where we move into pronunciations. One thing that Eternal Egypt did is when it used Egyptian pronunciations, it basically used, I'll call them budge style pronunciations or Egyptologies in pronunciations. Budge style pronunciations, you think you're seeing, he gives you what look like vowels and you pronounce vowels that aren't there. And then explain why in a sec. And the Egyptologies, is a purely artificial, intentionally artificial way of pronouncing Egyptian words so that Egyptologists can talk to each other. It's a way of dealing with the fact that these words changed a lot, their pronunciations changed a lot.
Yeah.
And we don't know the vowels of many of them. We do know the vowels of some of them, at least at certain periods. And the fact is that there were multiple dialects, and there was the fact that they changed, you know, like I say, over time, there were influences from different languages at different points. It's a complicated, complicated thing. And so, in order to teach someone basic Middle Egyptian grammar, you can't go into all that stuff. You need to just give them a framework to work from. So the framework is this. The Egyptian writing system did not represent vowels per se. So when a word is shown with a vowel, either it has been supplied or it is it's a consonant that's been converted into a vowel.
Okay.
So, and that's going to get us into a topic that you wanted to me to explain to you, which is what's going on with Ra and Re.
Yes.
All right. So let me give you where the in Egyptologies there are two Egyptian consonantal signs that are pronounced ah. One of them is what we call the Aleph bird or the Ah bird. And that looks sort of like a three. It's actually a three that's disconnected in the middle. It is related to a glottal stop because sometimes it became a glottal stop in some words.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it becomes a glide, like a Y, yeah, sound.
Yeah.
And sometimes it actually, in the very early days, it appears to have been some version of L.
Oh.
Or R.
Okay.
Now, when people will go, well, wait a minute, how could it be L or R? You know, well, if you know Korean, or you've ever heard Japanese people try to pronounce L and R in English, you know that there are some languages that have a sound that's in the middle.
Right.
This was some sort of lateral consonant.
Mm-hmm.
Navajo even has a lateral consonant that actually sounds to us like a weird form of ch. So they don't all have to be just sort of l sounds. And I just gave you two different forms of L. La 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 and all.
Okay.
One of them, my tongue actually hits the top of my mouth. One, it doesn't. And one has more energy in the back of the mouth. All. Okay. And you hear this in Arabic really clearly, but that's partially another story. Mm-hmm. So the other ah is a sound that exists in Afro-Asiatics, many Afro-Asiatics, and it's the ayin. It's part of Arabic. It used to be part of Hebrew, though Ashkenazim don't say it, but some Sephardim do. It was ancestrally part of Akkadian, but Akkadian dropped it and turned it mostly into, it colored vowels instead, probably because of influence from Sumerian or something.
Okay.
but it's very common in Western Semitics. It's found in Somali. That's when I say ayin, that sound, you're hearing a vowel most likely. It's not. It's a weird tightening of your throat. And it colors vowels around it. And that was a consonant.
Okay.
But we say ah. Okay, we say ah, but it was a consonant. We Westerners say ah. I tried to actually pronounce the ayins. So I'll say anach. That's unk.
Ah, okay.
And actually, that's only one form. If the infinitive of to live is anach. Oh. Oath is anach. now,
probably changing the way people are looking at their unk pendants right now. Their anach pendants right
yeah.
now. Like the
yeah.
one I'm wearing.
so the noun life actually is the same as the infinitive form here.
Uh-huh.
There's evidence for that, by the way. It's what's called a verbal noun in Afro-Asiatic.
Wow.
It's an infinitive or a verbal noun. And so basically, kids, if you already speak Arabic, you have a leg up on all of us Euro speakers, because you can actually pronounce ancient Egyptian way better than we can.
Wow.
And the grammar will seem natural to you in many ways. Not all, but many ways.
That's cool.
It's pretty much related to Berber and Arabic, and perhaps less so Berber and Semitics. Less so to languages like Hausa or Somali. So let's get back to Ra.
Right.
So Ra and Re. So what's going on with that?
Yeah.
Well, Ra is actually already, a little light should be going in your head now. Okay, it's R and it's followed by an A vowel. Mm-hmm. So what does that mean? It's one of those two consonants, isn't it? That's not a vowel. It's a consonant. It's either the a bird or it's an ein. It turns out that in the name for the sun and the sun god Ra, it is an ein. And right now, if someone is using Coptic in the church and they want to say the sun, they will say this word, re.
Okay.
All right. So re is actually a real pronunciation of the word.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very, very late one. It now is just used for sun, but in Coptic, it can also mean the sun god Ra, re.
Okay.
So here's the cool thing, and here's where my passion is, what did that sound like earlier? What did that sound like when people were writing the ritual texts and pronouncing these ritually?
Yeah.
Because there is a music, there is a rhythm, there is a beauty to the way those words are structured in Egyptian, something that is basically completely walled off from most Western people until you know the language.
Right.
They used the sounds of words as a way to build the structure of the meaning and the sacredness and the power of the utterances. And so let's look at this one word. We actually have evidence from cuneiform of how that word was pronounced in the late 18th and 19th dynasties. Hey.
Is it Egyptian cuneiform or more Middle Eastern from the Fertile Crescent?
Well, cuneiform is basically Akkadian.
Okay.
Or one of the dialects of Akkadian, like Assyrian. Okay. So those two are very close together. Okay.
Uh-huh.
Akkadian is generally older, and then Assyrian becomes later. But that doesn't mean that Akkadian stopped being used, because it was used by the Neo-Babylonians too. And those languages also undergo sound shifts and grammatical shifts, but not quite the same ways. In the case of the cuneiform transcriptions of Egyptian words that we have, those are part of the international correspondence of the period of the New Kingdom. Because the lingua franca for international correspondence was cuneiform, not Egyptian. And so basically the earliest example we have is a letter from one of the Hittite kings written in cuneiform to Amenhotep III.
Uh-huh.
And like almost all Egyptian kings, he had the word Ra, Re, as part of his name.
Mm-hmm.
Not his Amenhotep name, the other name, the more important name. Okay?
Right, because they had several names.
Yes. And his is Neb-Ma'atre.
Mm-hmm.
That becomes, now I'm just going to give you the last part of it, which is Re, or Ra. It's Ria.
Ria.
Ria. And the way we think, we use that evidence. So now we are, you know what, we are nearly 1350 plus three. We are like 1650 years earlier than the Coptic pronunciation, okay? Mm-hmm. And admittedly, Akkadian doesn't actually have an ein sound. It doesn't have it. So they don't put an ein between the E and the A, but that's where the ein goes.
Wow.
So the word originally was real. Or Ria. So it would have started out with the accent on the E.
Uh-huh.
And then there was a little extra little vowel ending there, which probably started out as a short oo,
yeah,
and then sort of turns into an ah. And that was heard by the Acadian people as ah.
Okay.
So, oria, oria, oria. And his full name is Nebmaat Ra, is Nipmuaria.
Wow.
And now you also know something about the pronunciation of the word for Ma'at, which is Mo'at. Very, very different. And unfortunately for everybody, it has both of those two sounds in it. Uh-huh. And so it might have originally sounded something like Mulat or Morat. Mulat, very hard to say, but that is the case where it would have turned into a glottal stop followed by an I. Mulat.
Wow.
That is super hard to say for a Westerner, and hard for me to say. I admit that freely. You have to practice. But the first the vowels in that are actually u and a, and the a is the feminine determinative, the feminine ending for a noun. By the way, just like Hebrew and Arabic. And the final T, I'm pronouncing it with a T, but by the Middle Kingdom, it was probably mostly not said in ordinary speech. Uh-huh. And part of my current thinking is that in highly structured ritual speech, it probably was still said. Just mm-hmm. like right now in Arabic, if you are reading the Quran, Al-Karim, you actually pronounce all of the tamarbutas, which is the T that is accompanying a feminine ending, except the very last one before you take a breath.
Wow.
And then it's just an ah.
So it's interesting, a question about an Egyptian word you use, I'm trying to keep a mental count here, I think maybe three or four different languages that you're familiar with to either relate to, or in the case of the letter you were talking about, having to go to this other ancient language to determine how an Egyptian word was pronounced.
Mm-hmm. that's right. We use a number of them. These transcriptions in other languages that were actually written with vowels.
Yeah.
Or some vowels. They might not have every single vowel. Mm-hmm. And that's true of Akkadian, for example. E and E in Akkadian are pretty much indistinguishable. The signs aren't either. If you think about that, it could be that already they might have heard that more as rea instead of rea.
Uh-huh.
And actually, that makes a whole bunch of sense because an E vowel, even in Arabic, if there's an ayn after it, will tend to pull towards a rea. If you listen to, and it's even stronger in Egypt, a lot of E vowels become a in Egypt, in colloquial Egyptian, today, right now. So phonetics and phonology and phonemics is a really, really complex field. But of the languages, the written forms vowel information, the oldest are Akkadian, then Assyrian, then kind of a combination of borrow words from and into Egyptian, by Western Semitic languages. Then you get Carian and Greek. Carian is a form of Greek. It's kind of an outlier dialect of Greek, mm-hmm. almost a separate language status, but you know, maybe it's a dialect.
Yeah.
I'm not a classicist. Somebody might want to correct me there, and that'd be great. I'd love to know. what people currently think about Carrion. It's spelled with a C, by the way.
Okay.
And they were some of the earliest Greek-speaking Aegean people and Asia Minor people who became mercenaries in Egypt. And that started in the 26th dynasty.
Oh, wow.
And it's actually mentioned in Herodotus. And colonies started to form in northern Egypt in a place that the Egyptians basically said, here, you can build your place here.
Oh, wow.
And that's up in the Delta.
Yeah.
And it's a place called Naucratis.
Oh,
and so that started long before the Ptolemies, like 300 years before the Ptolemies. Yeah. So we've got Greek. And then the Greek, of course, lasts for a long time.
Right.
And then that shades into Coptic. And Coptic uses Greek letters, but it actually maintains more of the old phonology. And it depends a lot on the period and the dialect and the text. Because Coptic, there's a version of Coptic called Old Coptic that that was used to gloss demotic texts, sometimes hieratic texts, for words to give the pronunciations of at least the stressed vowel.
Mm-hmm.
That means the vowel with the accent. Because there tends to be a kind of constriction of short vowels in Coptic that become indistinguishable. And there's a special term for that. We won't go into it. But the stressed vowel is the one that was most salient to the meanings, and this was already underway in Demotic. And they would sometimes use Greek letters to explain this, and they use more Greek letters than exist in modern Coptic, or Coptic that is considered modern, which it's not a lived language today. It's used in the church and people who study it. It has a lot of literature. It has a lot of literature, but most of that is highly Christian in scope.
Yeah.
But the old Coptic stuff is not. Some of that is pagan. That's actually starts sometime in the period of the Ptolemies. But becomes more common in the Roman period, much more common. And so there were special signs for things like stop. Then there's special signs. There's actually special signs for ein even sometimes. So ein is one of those last sounds to drop out and be elided away because of influence of Greek. So you could say that Coptic is like an Afro-Asiatic language that lost a lot of its Afro-Asiatic pronunciation-ness because of contact with Greek.
Well, it seems also from what we've just been talking about, good examples of some of the things that we've talked about in our conversations that over its very, very long history, it did not stay the same. Pronunciations did not stay the same. The Egyptian language was not born fully formed necessarily, like a lot of conspiracy theorists tend to talk about, but also that Egypt did not exist in a bubble, that it was not completely insular, that it dealt with other cultures, other societies, I'm pretty sure, throughout the length of its history.
Absolutely. And that is wonderful because that helps me give you a few more of the other languages that print that have vowels in them. One of them is actually, we have them in Phoenician.
Wow.
Well, Phoenician doesn't actually have vowels. And Phoenician is like Arabic and Hebrew. The way they are spelled sometimes, the same is true of Aramaic, gives us hints.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't pointed like modern Hebrew or modern Arabic or later Aramaic, but But Aramaic was also a language that was used a lot. It was the administrative language of the Persian Empire.
Uh-huh.
And so Jewish people came in and were living. A lot of times they were refugees from the kingdom of Judah, the northern kingdom, which had been destroyed by the Assyrians.
Mm-hmm.
And the Persians kind of, I don't know if they settled them or they it was just a happy coincidence that they had escaped, and then they got to be able to use Aramaic. For whatever reason, they actually helped do the international correspondence at that period. Aramaic became the international language of diplomacy under the Persian Empire.
Wow.
The Persians didn't conduct their business in Persian in Egypt. It conducted it in Aramaic. So Aramaic. But then we haven't talked much yet about connections further south, but those are very important too. And there are certain names of Egyptian deities that we have good evidence for from the language Meroitic and Napatan. Those are languages of Nubia.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually helps us center in on pronunciations of the name of Isis and Osiris.
Wow. Well, that also raises the questions there too. How do you most normally say the words for that great goddess and that great god?
Usit and Usuri.
Usit and Usuri.
Yeah.
Was that fairly close?
Yes, you did it perfectly. Those two names that I just used, please, no one take this that if you don't say it that way, you're wrong.
Right.
Because it's not true. Right. If you want to know how it was said in Greek times, the name of Isis was more like Esa. Esa. And Osiris could have been either Alser, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Or Alsir, Osir. And that's why you get the spellings you get in Greek.
Mm-hmm.
Realize that many Greek spellings, the Greek doesn't have a lot of these sounds, and there's no way of spelling them, even if it does.
Yeah.
If they're in the middle of a word, like you can't put an H in the middle of a word in Greek. You just can't. There's no way to spell it. But you can show an H at the beginning of a word.
Mm-hmm.
Hathor was said like that, Hathor. Not Hathor, not Tha, but Hathor. We know that a lot from Coptic, because even though they would use a Greek theta or theta in some words sometimes, it always is actually a T followed by an H.
Right.
With the exception of when it's a later borrow word from Greek itself, and then they would copy the Koine pronunciation. But that was probably in later Coptic, not so much earlier Coptic.
Okay. So with the theta, that brings to mind Yehuti and the modern spelling Thoth, and the pronunciation could be Tehut or something like that. Tehut.
Yeah, I mean, and if I was to say that in kind of a clipped pronunciation, you can see that the Greek spelling is doing something as long as you realize that that T followed by an H is there. So it's Tehut.
Got it.
Or Tehalte. And that Tehalte is one problem there is that Greek has problems with endings of words. Uh-huh. You know, Greek has rules about how a word can end.
Okay.
And that was strong at some points that eventually breaks down more. But that's why you have an S on the end of Isis, an S on the end of Osiris.
Ah.
Those are Greek endings.
Right.
They have nothing to do with the Egyptian sounds.
Okay.
Nephthys Nibtot.
Nibtot.
or nimmt Hot. It might have been Hot. I'm so you know, just to be have the most fidelity to the way it was written in Greek, nimmt Hot. So you can hear me doing the T and the H really close together.
Yeah.
And the B almost becomes a P, because it really is Lady of the Hut, the enclosure.
Mm-hmm.
And that was probably originally Hut, and that's why you hear me say Hut.
Okay.
And that's me. So some other gods and goddesses that people might be interested in is Amun. Yes, Amun, that's how it sounded. Mm-hmm. Eventually.
Thank goodness for an easy one.
It was originally Amano.
Uh-huh.
Amano. And we know that because we've got Akkadian transcriptions of it being Amano.
Uh-huh.
So you can literally see the change.
Yeah.
In the actual evidence, I'm not making that up. And for two others that have the same pattern, the god, sometimes written as just Tem or Tom or mm-hmm. Atom, is Atamu.
Atamu.
And guess what? Well, Atum, notice that they are very similar.
Yeah.
Amun, Atum. Those are the Greek transcriptions, roughly, mm-hmm. of those two names. And that is a standard vowel transformation, just like E to A for Rea and Re is, that's a standard vowel transformation too. And if you have a long stressed A, long or stressed A in a word, it will tend to go to either O, like Hotep, Hotep, or it will go to U. And if there are M's and N around it, if there's a consonant M before or after, or N before or after, and the rules of that are a bit shaky, they're not super precise, it will become U. So Amun from Amal, Atum from Atamu. And can you guess the next one? Anup from Anapu.
Ah, okay.
That's Anubis.
Right.
And that actually exists to this day as a personal name for Christians in Upper Egypt.
Oh, wow. That's
and it's cool. Abanub. Abanub. Arabic doesn't have P, so it becomes a Panup or Panup. Becomes Banub, and then they sort of add an A in front, so Abanub, which kind of makes it into an Arabic pattern that's related to Arabic. So they're doing a little transformation there, the same way that Greek did, but it's a different one.
So to bring it back to Ra or Re,
yes.
Which do you use most in your practice? And does it matter whether it's standalone or at the end of a word or the end of a name? Does that change the pronunciation? But if we were to do a ritual today that had the name Ra in it, how would you pronounce it?
I would say Hario.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And again, that's sort of a schwa vowel on the end.
Uh-huh.
But I might say, you might hear me say Hario, and you might hear me say Ria. In other words, it doesn't matter too much.
Yeah.
This is weird for Westerners. Arabic is like this. Certain vowels in certain positions, the exact quality doesn't matter too much.
Nice.
They're almost like little placeholders. They, uh-huh. It's not the salient feature. And they also tend to shift a lot depending on the consonant that's around them.
Hmm.
And that's a really hard one until you just got to get it into your ears. You know, and I don't want to go into different Arabic words to explain that or show examples of it, but like the difference between an ah and an ah is dependent on the consonants around it.
So with all the pronunciations that we've talked about, and to me it's fascinating, and I love hearing you talk about it, and it could be the sort of thing that clearly a pagan who is interested can learn something new every day, can incorporate into their practices, can keep things fresh. What would you suggest or talk about to somebody who is interested in Kemetic Reconstructionism? How to get started? Basic beginning tips, advice, sources, KemeticTemple.org has great information on it, especially like the whys, like why try to be so authentic? I think Richard Reedy wrote an essay that's posted on KemeticTemple.org, like why try to be and maybe authentic isn't the word, but why try to reflect the practices of several thousand years ago?
Yeah. And actually, that's a great question also, because your questions have tended to be really good and to the point.
Well, thank you.
Before I leave the subject of pronunciation, though, I want to give people a flavor of what this can sound like when it's or reconstructed Egyptian, which is as real as we can make it right now. I actually know scholars who work in this field, and we collaborate. So it's not like I'm constantly shifting my thoughts here. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are things that are even in the book that I might be doing differently, but there are in the Everlasting Egypt, you know, kind of wrapping that whole cycle of story up. Rich asked me the week before he died, literally about 5 days, if I would update the Egyptian portions of the general rituals to more reconstructed pronunciations. Because he heard me say them. I was developing my work in this period when he was living. And he said, could you do that? Mm-hmm. And then he passed away. And I was the person who put the book together, basically. I had some help from the other temple members, but mostly, by and large, it was me. I paid for it. I got that book done, and it was a labor of love. He wanted me to do that. He wanted to be sure that the book was finished.
Yeah.
He said as much that I think I've now, you know, done my life's work because I have finished this book. And then 7 days later, he had passed away. I mean, that was literally true. High C. Lutmers was there, and so was Alan Phillips, who is our other founding member. We were all three in the room in that conversation when Rich said this works. But in between, I think it was on Tuesday after that, it was a Saturday till Tuesday, he asked me to do this. So here is an example of what it sounds like, the difference between what was in Eternal Egypt versus what I would say now fluently. So here's the first one. Peret erkeru mi pereret em re en netcher. That's what you see in Eternal Egypt.
Yes.
Ready?
Yep.
Peria per tharcharo mi pururiet maratni nacher.
Wow.
Yeah, now, one of those sounds like a language. And that's the goal here. Do you hear? It's got a kind of music to it. It's got a rhythm to it.
And it's said four times at the even in the brief ritual, it's suggested to pronounce that four times after you've made your offerings.
Right. And there's one extra word at the front that I added. And he knew about that. And that is because technically the way the translation works is may offerings of every kind come forth in abundance like the things that come forth from the mouth of the god.
Right.
And that's the form for a god, not a goddess. or multiple gods. Those would be different for the very last word, okay? But I basically may come forth is put in the front, and that's peria.
Mm-hmm.
But everything else is coming from the old part. And we use the term peret erheru, that means invocation offering, or peret archerau, peret archerau in Reconstruction.
Wow.
That means invocation offering, and that's the offerings of all kinds, because invocation offering does subsume the concept of many kinds of offerings.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it does. It's a vocal offering. It's one that you say. You don't actually, you know, pour libation and give bread and give beer and give wine and give alabaster vessels and give linen clothing and give the and incense and all kinds of things. You just say that little formula, and that stands for, and that's what we're doing.
Right.
Because when we say that, we are saying basically, you know, we have made some offerings. And yet it should stand for the whole nine yards of the complete offering set, which we can't do because we don't have the facility. And that's why he did that. There's history, there's a whole lot more to be said about where that phrase comes from. I will cover it on my blog, okay? I just haven't got there yet. But the-
Which by the way, is at imperishablestars.com.
Yes.
Okay.
So now I'm going to flip back to your real question here. A great place to start, you can look at kemetictemple.org. There you will find my contact information. It might be best not to use that one to get to me because we don't, it's not super actively used by us at the moment. We occasionally will look at them and then divvy up the questions for people, depending mm-hmm. on what the questions are. But I would say if a person really wants to get to me, put a comment on my blog. And I may not reply to you on the blog itself. In other words, but I get to look at all the comments that come in, and uh-huh. I'll reply to you by email, and if you'll let me know that. And actually, I can sort of tell most of the time. It may take me some time because I am doing academic stuff and research on my own for publications and things like this, so just be patient. It may take me a little while, especially at the hot points of semesters. So my blog, imperishablestars.com, that's going to give you stuff that may seem, it's kind of a grab bag of different kinds of material. It's definitely not one of these pagan blogs that attempts to talk about whatever the latest thing of the moment is. I focused on trying to show my own thoughts around vocalic reconstruction, Egyptian polytheism, and lately I have started actually doing really detailed explanations of what the brief daily ritual is, each section. So where that text comes from, how many versions of it might there be, how we have abridged it, how Rich abridged it, how it might better be translated in a slightly different way these days, since we all know more, about the Egyptian language itself than some of the material Rich was using. So I do a bunch of that kind of stuff. And I will work through the brief daily ritual, and then I will start on some of the portions of the general rituals also. And there will be some more material that will be brought in there to give some more context, like some of the things I've even been saying today. So those are great places to start.
Yeah.
Awesome. We otherwise don't have currently a presence that is public. We do have a very private Facebook group, mm-hmm. but we do not have a public Facebook group, mainly because Facebook time runs it runs in minutes and seconds, and no one of us has that time,
right,
to be sitting in front of our phone and replying to every little thing that happens.
Yeah.
It tends to be an incendiary medium, frankly. It could. So I would suggest coming to me at my blog first. I'll put one on kometictemple.org second, because that's a good place to catch it eventually. And then also I have now a Twitter feed, which is also Imperishable Stars, that is connected. And so connected in the sense that I basically only post stuff that I post on Imperishable Stars.
Yeah.
And so that one's going to be available too. I've only started to learn how to use Twitter. So I'm kind of behind, but that will be a place where when I next make my next post on Imperishable Stars blog, you will be able to check out my Twitter feed and you should see it there. If someone is interested in my blog, please, you can follow it. And if you follow it, you'll get a notification that I put something else up. They do not come every day. It's not like you're going to get a whole bunch of these. It takes me some time to do the research to pack the information in to what I need to say.
Well, when you do, I mean, it's deep. It's meaningful stuff, meaningful to people's practice. I mean, it's not just knowledge for the sake of knowledge. I mean, it's meaningful to people's practice if they want to use it. Yes. And your imperishablestars.com and kometictemple.org are packed with information that can be used for people's practice to expand their practice and to enrich it. And then and of course to contact you, but I mean, the place where I started was the books, and they're amazing.
Yes. And actually the books, the second book, Imperishable Stars, also has, I believe it has my email on it. So you can get to me that way too. If you look at Everlasting Egypt, you can see that.
Yeah.
Everlasting Egypt is a big fat book. I just warn you, it's heavy. It's 687 pages or something like that. It's,
yeah.
because it has so much material. And we did it that way instead of making it like the Book of Common Prayer. Rich didn't want to do that. The mm-hmm. Book of Common Prayer has a lot of material in it too, but you have to flip back and forth all the time.
Right, right.
And here, each one is as much as possible self-contained, so you can read straight through for each ritual. Yeah. And so that gives people a beginning and they can start. I want to say really, 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 it's really, really important that please do not use the complexity of our rituals or the things I've said about pronunciation to block what you do to start. When you start, it does not matter much, maybe at all, how you address a god or goddess. Use a name that you are comfortable with. My passion is saying it like, literally, like late 18th, early 19th dynasty priests would say it in ritual context.
Mm-hmm.
And if you know anything about ritual and ritual context and priests who are educated, you realize that's not everyday speak.
Right.
That's not what people were doing at home. And that Egyptians were the same way in this.
Yeah.
There is, and so please don't treat that like a barrier. Don't treat it like, you know, the demons are going to come after you if you don't say the word right. That really is not who our gods and goddesses are.
Mm-hmm.
Tamara Siuda from Kemetic Orthodoxy says the same thing.
Yeah.
I mean, our gods are patient. They have an immense history. They spread all over Europe, and then that faded, and then it's come back in a lot of different ways.
Yeah.
You know, Fellowship of Isis does a thing that's very different from us, and yet it's valid. We try to be have as much fidelity to the ancient texts from a certain set of periods as we can, but that doesn't mean we ape every single thing that are in them either.
Yeah.
We make choices, and those choices, you know, are the fact that we don't, that we allow all genders, that any gender can take any role. All that stuff is probably not ancient.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that we, in our particular tradition, don't have a notion of a king, even though ancient Egyptians very much had a king.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be a topic for another time. It's a huge topic because it's changing rapidly in Egyptology now, how that was working, how it developed. It was not a monolith in the same way that anything else is a monolith.
Yeah.
Even though the kingship broadcast itself to be a monolith at certain periods, that doesn't mean it was always like that.
Right.
Or everywhere was it like that exactly. It waxed and it waned. It came and it went. And it definitely had a development that's important to at least be cognizant of.
Yeah.
Be careful. I mentioned that there are African connections, mm-hmm. and these are an area that is a lot of new work is going on. And you know, that stuff is, some of it's amazing. I'm only just sort of learning about it.
Yeah.
The West tends to think of Egypt from a perspective that's oriented towards the Mediterranean and towards the Hebrews and the Greeks.
Mm-hmm.
It is at least as much rooted in the Nilotic peoples and Nilotic cultures and the cultures of the Sahara deserts.
Yeah.
At least as much, and actually ancestrally far more.
Right.
And so we have much, much, much to learn about those connections.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned Meroitic and Napatan as Nubian languages that actually influence our knowledge of pronunciations.
Yeah.
Well, there are religious things that are done to this day in Kenya that have some resonance to the cults of cow goddesses.
Wow.
In Egypt. It's there. It's highly transformed. Those people would call themselves Muslim now. By and large, but there are still practices and folk practices.
Mm-hmm.
There's resonances. Well, I've already told you about the linguistic ones. There's a lot of linguistic resonances, perhaps more than we realize in Berber languages. I know one scholar who's working on that, and there's not just one. Those are tough topics. They're difficult topics. And a lot is in flux. So don't take things as written in stone. And that includes your own practice.
Yeah.
If you start with one god or goddess and that eventually changes, it's okay. You don't have to be, it doesn't have to be a huge deal. Egyptians themselves were priests and priestesses of more than one god or goddess at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Or sometimes their professional life would actually involve a formal transition from one temple to another.
Right.
Both happens. We have records. So it's not like, it's probably the case that whatever you're experiencing, they had a precedence for. It probably is. So don't try to make it an either or a take it all or take none of it sort of proposition. We do feel it's important to have as much fidelity as possible in our particular brand, but there are other brands that take very different approaches.
Right.
So I don't want to also say that we're the only game in town. We're not.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be seen that way. So I think that probably wraps up that particular question.
Yeah. And I think one of the things also about the books is that for somebody who's researching Egyptian deities, the words used in the rituals to worship them is a really good place to learn about the deities, because this is how the Egyptians related to them. And
yeah.
Also going back to, you know, the why of doing the rituals, you learn through the books, Eternal Egypt and Everlasting Egypt, you learn about the deities, and through the practice, you learn about yourself as well. And
yes.
With those, the two websites and those two books, I mean, it's just, it's so much great information.
And we're, you know, it's kind of a constantly developing thing where it's alive. Something that we will continue doing as long as we can.
Yeah.
And I encourage people to take a look and try to understand. There's loads more to discuss.
Absolutely.
And you just brought up a point about the individual, like the individualized hymns and litanies and things like this that are special for any particular god or goddess that are in those rituals. The books also have references for those.
Yes.
And they may or may not be the fully up-to-date ones. And so that's what I do on my blog. I give you the more up-to-date references when I know them.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, some of those are in German or French.
Yeah.
So this is just a fact of life that our scholarship is in three major languages. And well, it's in more. It's also, some of it's in Dutch, some of it's in Italian. Some of it's even in Arabic.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to know about Coptic survivals in modern Arabic speech, the best book is a three volume set in Arabic.
Wow.
Well, come on, think about it. That's like completely natural.
Sure.
These are the people who speak this. They know it. They know that they use ancient Egyptian in talking about certain foods. They know that they use it like the first words you say to a baby to make them walk. That's ancient Egyptian to this day.
Wow.
In southern Egypt.
It's amazing all the languages that are involved in the study of Egyptology when you're talking to an Egyptologist who gathers so much information from all these different languages. I mean, it's kind of mind-boggling.
You know, I would love to do another one where we took a topic and sort of delved into it. And didn't try to cover the whole nine yards as much.
Absolutely.
One of them is, how do we read scholarship? How can we understand what we're reading and be critical of it,
mm-hmm.
and have a little skepticism, but at the same time figure out how to vet it?
Yeah.
How has Egyptological writing changed, and how is it changing as we speak?
Yeah.
Our field came out of colonializing Western Europe and America.
Right.
It is hegemonic. It basically sidelined actual Egyptians and their knowledge and their culture, because obviously they couldn't know, and because the Westerners had a very, very definite set of axes to grind. And so in some ways, the current Egyptian practices were simply irrelevant to them. Yeah. They had very definite notions about what they were looking for. And the main ones are things that proved the Bible. Yeah. And then the other was gold and art that they could take to their own countries.
Yeah.
And plus they had a vested interest in kings and big stuff and texts. And these things have all changed. And they're all being critiqued. They're all being rethought from the position of women and children in Egypt, the feminist kinds of analyses, queer aligned analyses, non-hegemonic ones, ones that look to Africa, not just the Middle East and Greece, ones that try to remove or try to pull off those weirdly colored filtered glasses so that we see Egyptian culture as the Egyptians express it as much as we can. That's really hard. It's ultimately not 100% possible, but we can use methodologies that are developed in disciplines as far apart as linguistics and literary criticism and anthropology to help us come to terms with what the issues are there.
Yeah.
Those were all of them, and to a large extent still are all of them, not paid much attention to by Egyptologists. And that's changing, I think, and it needs to change radically.
Yeah.
We need to pay more attention to Egyptian voices.
Absolutely.
We are totally missing the witnesses of people who were writing in Arabic throughout the Middle Ages about ancient Egypt, and some of that is jaw-dropping.
Yeah.
Because no one bothered with it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it wasn't relevant in the 19th century and most of the 20th, until the very late part of the 20th century, till the 80s I'm talking.
Yeah.
Just seeing magic and religion for how those were related in Egypt, how in fact they're the same thing in Egypt, not separate. Magic was never witchcraft in Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
It was never degraded or denigrated. It was not oppositional. It was built into what the gods gave to people.
Mm-hmm.
See, there's loads and loads of very interesting, almost dilemmas about the Egyptian culture and the way we look at them with our own filters, our own cultural, I don't want to use the word cliche, tropes is the more formal word for that.
Yeah.
Our own tropes that we need to actually kind of step back from and say, well, okay, how did the Egyptians actually use that word? What did it really mean? What were the contexts it was used in? And most of the time, they're pretty different than ours. Everything from Necher or Nacher and Nacharat, which is goddess, to Hetep or peace or contentment or satisfaction or Ach and Achet. Achet is not horizon. That's not the concept that's represented there. And so I'm gonna be quiet now, because those each are topics, and we could pick one and maybe do it again.
Yeah. Well, and when we get talking, I can talk to you for hours, and we have. And I thank you very much for your time today for this recording. Maybe we should, maybe you could give us some final thoughts for this recording, and then we can talk again soon, hopefully, for other topics that invariably, when we get talking, it leads to other topics. So maybe just for this recording, we could get your final words and some thoughts.
My final words and thoughts basically are thanks to everyone who's listened so this long. I'm just looking up going, oh my gosh, it's been way long. because you really had the stamina to sit through this and listen through this.
I love it.
It's a massive, Egyptian is a massive world of knowledge, of written and archaeological and artistic and religious materials, of survivals to the present day.
Mm-hmm.
It's got connections to cultures in Africa, the Middle East, Europe. It had diasporas that started long ago. And in some ways it's having new diasporas in just the last couple centuries. It's an amazingly diverse topic. And so I'm sorry if it's been long-winded. To dive into details, I know I do this, but I think it's kind of important. And I want to thank you for the time to discuss this stuff. As thoughts are concerned, again, take nothing without a grain of salt here. That I've said, I probably have misspoken and elided over and skips things that you may have questions about. That's good and it's healthy. Bring them up. Bring them up in the YouTube comments. Maybe we can see if we can get some of those answered. Sometimes they're better done verbally than they are done in text, these short little communications, because it's hard to express this stuff in 17 words or less. And I think I should leave it there for now. So thank you for the opportunity.
Well, for doing it's this. My pleasure. It really, truly is every time we talk. So thank you very much, Matthew Wheelton. We'll talk again soon. We'll hopefully record again soon. And please stay safe and stay healthy. And thank you for your work, by the way. Thank you so much for getting Everlasting Egypt put together and published and for sale in three different formats or four on Amazon. And these are amazing, incredible works. And then Kemetic Temple, Temple of Ra, and your blog, imperishablestars.com, all great. And thank you very much for making all those available to us. It's all fantastic and very meaningful for people that are interested and interested in practicing. We talked a lot about theories today, but putting these into practice is just beautiful and life-affirming and can be life-changing. So thank you for all the work that you've done.